Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Breitall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 261 for comics originally released on August 8th, 2012. Starting us off in DC is Batman number 12. Now, I usually, when I'm prepping for the show and stuff, you know, put together a text file so I can put my talking points together because I have horrible memory, whatever. And as part of that, I dig up the solicitation stuff. Now, this time, the solicitation text versus what was in the issue, I thought was pretty different. Now, DC's gone, like Marvel's been for a while, to the bullet point solicitation style, which I hate because it doesn't do a good job selling the issue. And the two bullet points for this issue were, it's the epilogue to the Court of Owls, and the next major storyline begins here. It's like, well, okay, that's kind of ambiguous and vague. And frankly, I didn't feel like this was really any particular epilogue to the Court of Owls or any particular major storyline was starting here. So
I would agree with that.
It wasn't what I was expecting based on the solicitation. But frankly, I thought it was actually much better than what I was expecting.
I would agree with that because, a lot of people, and I don't, there's nothing wrong with it, a lot of people loved the Court of Owls. Mm-hmm. I seriously disliked the Court of Owls, the entire storyline. I did not really care for it. I didn't care for the villains. I didn't, you know, it's just, it didn't do anything for me. And I came close to dropping Batman, but it's like, oh, you know, it's Batman. I'll stick with it and see what comes next. This issue I loved. You know, this in my opinion is the best issue of Batman that's come out since the relaunch.
I might even push it a little further back than that.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. It's probably the best issue of Batman that's come out in years, at least years, you know, from the best one I can remember. Let's say it's like
I was
going
to say, recent memory is the term I would use.
Yeah. Excellent issue.
What I liked with this is it was a great breather issue. It introduced what very well might be a new recurring character in Gotham City. We may never see Harper Row again, but who knows? And
That would be a shame.
It would, because she was an interesting character. I mean, I wouldn't want to see her necessarily every issue in some title, but periodically. And I'd like to see more issues like this, where we get to see just random, not random, but selected people in Gotham City. What was great about this issue is it also revealed some minor aspects of Gotham's history. Like how kind of the electrical system is in a state of major disrepair just because it's a century old or whatever, and it's kind of constantly getting patched together and stuff. And in this issue, they really sell, I think, successfully the concept that, you know, if you're living in Gotham, you know, particularly not one of the more affluent neighborhoods or whatever, it'd be realistic to be expecting brownouts, blackouts, just periodically, you know, because, well, you know, it's Gotham, it's the electrical system sucks, so, you know, look at somebody out and fix it. You won't be out for too long, but, I mean, it adds character and a rich detail to the city in the course of a very good story. Now, add to that, they also set up that Batman's been secretly augmenting the power grid in Gotham. And it kind of raises the question of, you know, how he did it, why did he do it secretly, whatever. But from like Harper Row's perspective, Batman is clearly just doing it with off the shelf equipment from Wayne Industries or whatever. And it really showed how by having what Batman uses going through the Wayne Industries stuff, equipment sold on the street and stuff, it's helping the Batman secret identity aspect of, well, just any regular Joe could do this. There were tons of little nuggets and things like that sprinkled throughout this issue that it's not like they said, well, let's stop telling Batman stories for an issue. Let's just do a fill-in on some random character that'll have nothing to do anything and move back to Batman next issue. This, while Batman is a supporting character in this story, and he definitely shows up quite a bit, it did a lot to really further his backstory and, you know, aspects of that, and I really enjoyed that. You know, I also liked how the events in this issue kind of overlapped with, you know, the Building a Better Gotham, you know, dinner and stuff from Batman 1, some other stuff in Batman 3, and it didn't seem to, like, really contradict those events or anything. And, I mean, let's face it, it's not too difficult this early on in the New 52 to keep things consistent, and I appreciate the fact that they did that.
Let's talk about the art for a minute.
Sure.
Now, Becky Cloonan, who did the first 21 pages of this, I really like, I mean, I situationally like Becky Cloonan. I didn't really care for her on Conan, because I just don't think her style matches the vision in my head of what Conan is. That's nothing wrong with her art. It's just me. Her work on Batman was really good. I enjoyed it. You know, because she did Demo and she did Local, and, you know, this story and her art style really melded nicely together. Then another part I liked about this is instead of getting a disjoint backup story like we get a lot in the $3.99 DC books, the story just continues on with James Tynion IV, and his art is really nice. This guy is someone I want to be watching for. I really enjoyed what he did in the last, the last seven, eight pages of the book. You know, that his art style is really nice. And it wasn't, even though it's a very different art style, I didn't feel like a jarring gear shift on it. You know, even though it kind of just, it switched over kind of in the middle of a scene, it worked for me.
But it shifted over with the introduction of Batman. And it kind of underscored the fact that, you know, his Gotham is a little bit different than everybody else's Gotham. And that's kind of where she, Harper Row, went from just being, you know, a citizen of Gotham to involved in Batman stuff for a little bit. So while, like you said, it's a different art style, the fact that they put a two-page ad in between it, giving an extra page flip and stuff, I think helped on that transition. Because I didn't find it the least bit jarring and stuff. And it's, like you said, a noticeably different art style. If it had been on facing pages or something,
yeah,
that I think would have been a little more jarring.
Which I assume, let's hope, that they did that on purpose, putting the ad placement where they did, and it worked. And it was really well, you know, the issue flowed really nicely together. I mean, there's nothing I could do to not give this a 5 out of 5. I mean, if I like look at this and say, oh, it's the best Batman comic book I've read in my memory, you know, well, boom, gets a 5 right there.
Because
it was a great comic book.
I have to agree with that. They did a great job on this. And, you know, like I said, they furthered the whole Batman mythos while telling a very different kind of a story. It's a good entry point into, you know, the title without a, let's stop, let's recap things, let's do a specific intro issue or whatever. The only complaint I would really have about this is I think they mis-solicited this. I think they could have pitched it in a way that a lot of people who aren't reading the title might have said, you know, hey, that sounds interesting, I'll give it a shot, you know, for a one-issue story, and they may have been pulled in and said, let's go with it going forward. So I think with such good contents, such a misleading and lackluster solicitation was just really unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, again, I didn't read the solicit and I didn't remember, so it didn't affect me, but they should solicit things the way that they're going to come out. But in this case, I'm glad it wasn't an epilogue to Court of Owls, because I probably wouldn't have enjoyed that anywhere near as much.
But conceivably, it very much could have affected you, because I know you pre-order your comics. If you'd been seriously on the fence, read that solicitation, and said, you know, I'm not liking Court of Owls, maybe I won't get this, or whatever. Whereas if it had actually pitched the story they told, you might have said, well, you know, yeah, I'll give it that extra issue. So I think the way they pitch the books, the way they solicit the books, is an important thing to be judging these things on. I mean, I'm not knocking points or anything off if it's different. In this case, it actually got some points on that score. But I think it's relevant to point out, from, you know, and that's part of why I dig these things up, is, you know, I know both of us order through DCBS, and obviously retailers are pre-ordering based on previews. A lot of our listeners are in a similar boat. So if publishers are consistently mis-soliciting or, you know, giving inaccurate or just incomplete or unhelpful information in the solicitation, I find it worthwhile to point that out. Hopefully that the publishers will actually learn how to solicit books well, because I think that would be one thing that would really help sales. But I don't expect that to happen anytime soon. Anyways, for me, 5 out of 5, too. It was a really great issue. I'd like to see them do more of these kinds of stories. Both the fact it was pretty much a done-in-one, and just it was a good slice-of-life kind of a thing. Shall we move on to Marvel?
Sure, we got Fantastic Four, number 609. Roaring towards yet another reboot of this title. It'll be starting over at a number one in another couple of issues with the new creative team.
I don't know if I'd have used the term roaring towards so much as snoring towards.
Yeah, well, there is that. This felt like, and I hope the next two issues are not going to be like this. It really felt like the DC titles felt before Flashpoint. It's just like marking time, tying up loose ends before the end. You know, we've had so many great stories from Hickman. And I understand, okay, I want to go back and wrap this thing up. It was this issue did pretty much nothing for me. It was kind of a tying up loose ends on this, New Earth or something storyline. And it was kind of a snoozer.
Well, it reminded me, and I hadn't thought about it until you mentioned the pre-Flashpoint stuff, of how that run of Justice League ended with an issue or two, which was basically a recap of all the storylines the writer wanted to tell but wasn't going to have the chance. So you got kind of the cutscenes, if you will, or the recaps of them. Here, it's just the one storyline, like you said, wrapping up the New Earth stuff. And, I mean, this was not one of Hickman's better issues of the Fantastic Four by far. You know, had I read this about a year and a half ago, which is roughly when the story starts compared to other issues of Fantastic Four, maybe I'd have enjoyed it more. But, I mean, this whole Defenders of the Future story arc is pretty old news to me right now. And focusing on what happens with all those characters, you know.
I don't think I needed to know.
Well, yeah. Well, the thing is, did you care what happened to Psionics,
no.
The Hooded Man, Natalie X, Alex Ultron, Lightwave, Banner Jr.? Could you even have named those characters at this point easily with, oh yeah, those guys? No, I mean.
Not at all.
Yeah.
I would have been fine if he would have just left that storyline where it was. Because as it is, going back and revisiting it, kind of like, I remember liking that. And based on this, I like kind of questioned. Like, but what?
I mean, the way I would have solicited this, kind of sarcastically, would have been a, hey, remember these guys? And kind of an implied no. Well, we forgot to tell you how things ended for them, so here it is. And that was really underscored where, you know, again, starting out with a week after the death of, you know, on the caption on the first page, it's like, wow, that sets it back a year and a half. And then we get a little bit, and then cut to later. Get a little bit, cut to later. Get a little bit, cut to later. It's like we're getting the Cliff Notes version of the story. You know, it felt like too much of this was told to us versus shown to us. And it's not a bad story, but it completely failed to engage me as a reader. And I've been really loving what Hickman's been doing on the Fantastic Four. So, I mean, to me, that's a pretty impressive fail.
Yeah, I had to go with the 2 on this issue, just because it doesn't, a 3 is a good, solid comic, and I didn't feel that this was. You know, and what you said about, you know, it's just like cutscene to cutscene and just jumping and recapping as it did. It's just, it's one of the weakest issues in Hickman's entire run on Fantastic Four.
I would be hard-pressed to name any issue in his run that I think was weaker. And I'm going to include those 2 fill-in issues on the Inhumans.
I think those were. This is my personal, but, you know, this one didn't do a whole lot for me. And again, I just hope we don't get a repeat of this performance on the next 2 issues, because I would really not want to go out on such a stellar run that Hickman's been doing on Fantastic Four with kind of a sour taste in my mouth on just a bunch of weak issues that are just wrapping things up. And I wish he would just pull out the stops and go out with a bang on his last couple of issues. But, you know, if he goes out with 3 issues like this, he's going to be given Fraction a T-ball to hit, because you know, I've heard people say, I mean, wow, Fraction's really going to have to do a lot to, you know, follow Hickman on Fantastic Four. Well, if I just read three issues like this, I would be open to whatever Fraction serves up.
Well, the next issue is supposed to be the Wizard coming back to collect his son or his clone or whatever that's part of the Future Foundation. So I think that's something Hickman's been setting up for a while, and I'm hoping that'll have some good payoff. I don't expect it to read like this issue, but you know, we'll find out next month when we get that issue how well they did. Because I got to agree, this to me is a 2 out of 5. It was very disappointing. I know as a writer, Hickman is capable of so much more, both in general and specifically on this property. He's been delivering such great stories pretty much throughout his run, with very few notable exceptions, and this was just a major disappointment of an issue.
Yeah. Okay, and last up for us on our main three stories is Valiant's latest number one, Archer and Armstrong. Fred Van Lente writing, Clayton Henry on art. I love this issue. This to me was the best of the Valiant books that's come out so far, and certainly the best number one that they've had. I just, you know, they had so, and a lot of people are like, well, I never read the first Archer and Armstrong. I didn't know. You know, none of the Valiant relaunch stuff requires you to have any prior knowledge of the Valiant universe. You don't have to have read the previous Archer and Armstrong. For Exo, you don't have to have read any previous, you know, Bloodshot, you know, none of that. You don't, Harbinger, it's all new. They're telling the stories from the ground up in these new issues. They're telling really good stories, and you don't have to have any prior knowledge. So don't let that be a barrier to entry of, wow, I never read Valiant back when they were first coming out. Doesn't matter. Just pick the books up and read them. They're great first issues that bring you into the Valiant universe. And this one, boy, Van Lente's take, I mean, I like how they set up the three brothers. And you know, if you read the old stuff, there's a little bit of, you know, kind of Easter egg, kind of between the line stuff that you pull in, but it's not necessary to being able to read and enjoy the story.
It might almost be, I don't want to say a hindrance, but because I've got that point of comparison, it's like, well, okay, you know, this Galad was the Eternal Warrior, Ivar is formerly Time Walker, how's that going to play in? Is it? And it very well may not, you know, so I'm bringing a little excess baggage to me with this title. Whereas if you're just coming at it clean, you're able to really enjoy this story as just this story. And certainly I would hope nobody is steering away from the Valiant stuff thinking they needed to go read that older material. I mean, the older material was great, but this stuff, they're doing just some amazing work. And when you say this is the best first issue they've done, I'm sitting here thinking, well, you know, I thought that Harbinger first issue was really good. I thought that Bloodshot issue was really good. The Exo was good, not as good as the others. So, I mean, they've come out with their A game and, you know, are trying to earn their readership, and I really respect that. They're not trying to coast on, well, you know, remember that old Valiant stuff back in the day? Well, here's a little bit more of it. Which is kind of how I felt with the Magnus stuff the Dark Horse tried to relaunch. It felt like it was almost a continuation thereof. No, this was a really good issue. You know, I liked how we were introduced to the three brothers. I mean, obviously things ended badly pretty much for everybody in that prologue. But apparently life was able to crawl back out of the ocean somehow and restart things. And then how we get introduced to Archer and how he gets set up as just being this amazing fighter. And really, that bit where they do the call-outs for the different skills and stuff like that, that worked surprisingly well. If you had tried to describe that to me, or somebody was pitching it to me, well, I'm going to do this. I'm like, I don't know. It worked much better than I would have expected if somebody described it.
I think that worked really well. The only thing I will say, and it's just because my eyesight isn't what it used to be, on the ones where Savate and the Krav Maga.
Yeah, dark text, black text on a dark background.
Tiny little black text on a dark background. Guys at Valiant, don't put black text on a dark background. Switch to white text. you know, or yellow or something
or
that provides
put a caption around it like they do for Taekwondo.
You know, put some contrast in there because I frankly, without getting out a magnifying glass, I cannot read the words under Sabate. Mm-hmm. You know, and just I can read the capoeira just fine. I can read Taekwondo because they put the caption on it. You know, I can read the titles. But I think it's really cool how Archer's got all these different fighting styles and he's using it. And, you know, we introduce all those other kids at the theme park kind of environment. You know, I'm hoping that, and there's no way they're not going to play into the story down the line. But, you know, just how they introduced Archer and Armstrong to one another and then, you know, the setup at the end of the issue. This is perfect pacing in this. And it leaves me not on a shocking full page cliffhanger or anything, but what a number one issue should be of, wow, I can't wait to read the next one. You know, what more can I ask for?
Well, what I liked is there was an efficiency to the storytelling. And I mean, like the way Archer had been raised by the Dominion was more kind of implied than really shown. I mean, we get bits and pieces, but it's pretty clear, you know, how he'd been brainwashed, etc. Not brainwashed, but, you know, raised to believe very specific things. And how with, you know, just a panel or two, we get that one of the other kids had run away for a bit and come back. And then we get a little twist on that. We get some really good insights on this stuff. Without them having to either belabor the point or recap of, well, when I was a kid, this happened or, you know, whatever. And like you said, that reveal at the end, really worked and kind of helped set the tone for the series. It really, to me, we'd had a really good issue and that just kind of kicked it up a little bit of a notch and, you know, set the direction. And I loved the captions we get as Archer is heading to New York, as he gets to New York, because it gives us some insight on both him and his upbringing. And they did just a wonderful job setting up all the characters, the conflict, the relationships, and a lot of what's going to make it a unique title. So they did a brilliant job with this. And I'm glad that pretty much every first issue we've gotten from Valiant has been just kind of knocking it out of the park. And not doing a slow burn or, you know, something else like that. Well, wait until you get to issue 5 or 6 and then it all comes together. It's like, well, how many people are going to do that these days? It's too competitive of a market. And, you know, the fact that they don't do that here, I think was just a very wise move. And I'm looking forward to more of this series.
Yeah.
So I'm giving it a 5 out of 5. I suspect you are too.
Absolutely. When I read this book and I put it down, I'm like, wow, that's what a comic book should be. You know, and that to me is like when I read something like that, when I have that kind of reaction, I can't give it anything but a 5.
Yeah.
Well, great comic book.
As a first issue, this did everything it needed to. Introduce the characters, the backstory, the crux of the dilemma or, you know, a conflict that's going to happen. Give me a sense of the style, the taste, the direction. Don't telegraph everything, of course. And I also liked how pretty much, I think, everything they put in the solicit, and it was a pretty detailed solicit, is in the issue. You know, it was pretty much exactly what they said it was going to be, and what they said it was going to be was pretty interesting. So, you know, I was very pleased on that score as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Other things of note this week, I had a couple other number ones that I thought were really well done. Idolized number one came out. Now they had a 0 issue. The number one issue was great also. I don't know if you had a chance to read it yet.
I've read my entire stack.
Yeah. So I thought really nice job on Idolized number one. That was a great comic book. One you probably didn't read. Godzilla Half Century War.
No, didn't get that.
Now that one, James Stokoe, who's done Orkstein, he did this. He wrote and drew this. Wow, this was great. His style really meshes with the Godzilla property and the little subtleties. If you're like Godzilla movies at all, he had call outs in this issue back to the little subtle ones. Well, maybe not so subtle if you're familiar with it, but back to the original Japanese version of Godzilla, which was Gojira. And, that, you know, the first Godzilla movie in Japan had almost a different different plot line through it when they did the American version and kind of spliced scenes with Raymond Burr into it. It kind of changed the movie around. So if you've ever seen the original Japanese version of Godzilla, you know, this, I was really happy with what Stoko did to this. And you could tell the guy's a real Godzilla fan. Nicely done. Can't recommend that enough to anybody who's a fan of that. I also got some artist edition portfolios this week from IDW. They had the Neil Adams Thrill Kill artist edition and the Bernie Wrightson Muck Monster. And these were very nicely done, too. I mean, you've seen the artist editions, John, right? The
big oversized
books. These, they're not, you know, the fully bound book because they didn't have, you know, they try to put about 100 to 120, 140 pages of original issues, you know, so 5-6 issues of comics into one of those full artist editions. Well, in this case, they didn't have that much of the work that they had in original art. So what they did was they went back to a single 8-10 page story from Creepy or Eerie that these artists did, and they put that in the portfolio. And it's just kind of like loose pages of art. On the back, it's printed, you know, this is not original art, you know, just so someone doesn't try to palm it off as original art to someone. But, you know, it's like the same, you know, full color reproductions of black and white art, which means you can see white out. You can see if the page, since it's really old, has yellowed a little bit, or if there's blue line, or I don't think there was, I don't think they had blue line pencils back when these guys were doing it, but, very nicely done. And the portfolio is kind of like a hardback almost portfolio, not like, if you remember from years ago when back in the, maybe it's the 80s or 90s when portfolios used to be really hot commodities. They used to do a lot of them.
Yeah, I got a few of them, and they were just kind of like in a folder. And
yeah, and like kind of a flimsy cardboard, you know, kind of sleeve, right?
Yeah.
These are very nice. I mean, it's like you open it up, it's like kind of the covers of a hardback, and it's got a pouch inside for the art to go in. Very nicely done. And the, you know, the price on them, it's a little more than, you know, they're like $30, I think, as the retail price. Mm-hmm. On these, which, you know, per page puts them more, you know, because you pay like $100 or $120 for an artist edition, that brings your price per page down to about $1 a page, whereas here you're paying, you know, maybe $3 or $4 a page for the art that's in it. But, you know, hey, you know, any one of these actual pages of original art would cost thousands of dollars. So pretty good deal if you're interested in seeing what the original art would look like for something like this.
Yeah. Now, one thing I'm glad I picked up at Comic-Con is Omega Paradox number 4. That was something that there was some issues with Diamond having, you know, canceled it, possibly uncanceling it, whatever, through DCBS. My order got canceled. So, you know, I've got the issue, so I'm good. But I'd gotten it because while I was at San Diego, DCBS had sent an email saying, hey, we're canceling this. And I went and talked to the creator, you know, Mark Sparacio, and he was like, yeah, here's what happened. And it seemed like, and I've hear stories like this periodically, not quite routinely, but more often than I'd like, where due to, you know, various odd events, what happens through Diamond can really hurt the sales for smaller publishers. And this was one of those cases where to do certain things to please Diamond, it had unfortunate ramifications down the line, which wound up with, you know, this issue getting, you know, seemingly canceled for a bit over a miscommunication, or I forget the exact details, but it's one of those things where, you know, I've heard kind of essentially horror stories like this, where, you know, here's a, you know, in this case it's from Moonstone, but here's some guys trying to get their book out, and it's tough going sometimes through no fault of their own. So, like I said, I'm glad I bought that from them, while I had the chance face to face, cause it turns out my order did fall through. And again, I don't really blame DCBS for that, cause I mean, Diamond actually canceled the book there for a bit. That's just one of the many ways I think the way comic sales, work is just kind of fundamentally broken, that sort of a thing can happen. So.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I mean, that was a great issue too.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad I saw them at the con, and it's just a shame that, you know, what happened there.
Well, I mean, I've heard cases where, you know, publishers, like, would have sent out stuff for Free Comic Book Day, clearly marking what's for what's a for sale item, what's a free item, and that getting mixed up, and their for sale stuff going out for free, you know, or things getting lost at the Diamond Warehouse, you know, for a couple of months, and then gee, it's late, it gets canceled, you know, all kinds of horror stories. And they don't happen that often. I mean, Diamond's a big company; mistakes are going to get made. It happens, but you know, my philosophy on that kind of a thing is mistakes are excellent opportunities for companies to show how great their customer service can be. And that customer service is both towards, in Diamond's case, retailers, but also towards the publishers. They're providing a service for them. And if they'd been able to come out with the publisher saying, wow, it was unfortunate, but Diamond really came through for us in this way. I mean, I'd love to hear stories like that, but usually, yeah, not quite the case. So, I'm trying to think what else I read that was pretty interesting. Like I said, I've gone through the entire stack. X-Men Legacy was pretty good. I'm a little frustrated they're going to be reusing that title in the Marvel Now stuff. It's like, you know, have you run out of good titles for X-Men books? What else? We got Atomic Robo, It Girl, another Atomic Robo.
Oh, It Girl, you know, it's worth talking about. I really liked the Mike Norton art in this. I mean, mm-hmm. I would like to see Mike Allred, and it's nothing against Mike Allred, because I think Mike Allred did a great job on this issue, but I'd kind of like to see Mike Allred doing it instead of being on FF, but, you know, I'm sure, you know, he'll make a lot more money doing FF for Marvel, so can't begrudge him that.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's pretty much all I got. You got anything else? Are we done?
That does it for me.
Cool.
Join us next week when we discuss Green Lantern Corps number 12 from DC, Daredevil number 17 from Marvel, and Elephant Men number 42 from Image Comics.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.